Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Elmer Kelton's Sons of Texas series. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Daniel Stevens, Drew Copas, Yasmin Toison, Elizabeth Jernigan, Richard Rowan, David Coyne, James Konacek, Michael John Casey, Colleen Delaney, Ren Casey, Christopher Sheeran, Thomas Keegan, Jeff Allen, Laura Reichert, Ken Jackson, Michael Glenn, Joseph Thornhill, Joe Brack, Nanette Savard, Danny Gavigan, Lily Beacon, and Mort Shelby. Sons of Texas, number one, part two, The Westward Trace. Michael had shunned the Blackwood place in the years since his return from Texas, for it stirred bitter memories and pain. He couldn't see that it was one bit improved since the time he'd come here and accused Cyrus to his face. The fields showed but little sign of spring plowing and planting. Old weeds from last year, their stems dried hard as rawhide, stood testament to the heritability of shiftlessness. Not a soul was working in the fields, though this was a time when every able body should be there. Atop a gentle slope stood a double log cabin whose walls had not been plumbed the day they had gone up, and now they swayed lazily to the north as if waiting only for a strong wind to lay them over. Chickens prowled the yard, scratching for bugs and worms. The work stock stood idle in a pen carelessly thrown together with timber of all sizes and lengths. Michael wondered if anybody had bothered to feed them. Just then, Blackwood came out onto the narrow porch with a rifle in his hands. He was flanked by his sons, ranging in age from Luke and Isaac down to a boy of 8 or 10, a name Michael didn't even know. Finnis should be there, for he was the oldest. Michael checked the powder in the rifle's pan, then rode boldly up to the porch. He felt hostile eyes fastened upon him, and he tried to return the look in kind.
I've come to see Finnis. Where's he at?
Black-bearded Cyrus took a half step forward. He jerked his head toward the cabin door.
He's in yonder.
Michael started to dismount. Cyrus brought up the rifle and Michael stopped, his left leg half over the horse's back.
Finnis has got plenty to answer for.
When Cyrus didn't reply, Luke stepped forward.
So do you, you son of a bitch.
Michael stared hard into Cyrus's eyes. Cyrus tried, but couldn't hold. He lowered his eyes and the muzzle of the rifle. Michael finished dismounting and looped his reins over a post set in front of the porch.
I'm coming in.
He walked directly toward Cyrus. Cyrus waited until Michael was almost within arm's reach, then took one step to the side. When Isaac saw his father was caving in, he stepped in front of Michael.
My quarrel is with Finnis, not with you.
Let him go on in, Isaac. Let him see the damage he's done.
Old Lady Blackwood sat in a handmade wooden chair beside a rude bunk. She was holding a handkerchief to her eyes. In the close and choking gloom of the place, Michael saw Finnis Blackwood lying on the cot. He saw bloody cloth scattered on the floor, and one wrapped around the stump of Finnis's right arm. His face had the same gray look Michael had seen in his uncle's. Finnis was unconscious. He looked as if he might even be dead. Mrs. Blackwood's eyes smoldered with hatred as she arose from her chair.
If you come to finish the job, there ain't much left for you to do.
His arm was shattered. Wayne's had to take it off. Proud of yourself, Michael Lewis?
Michael had come with every intention of killing Finnis if he gave the least excuse. He had not come to see him butchered up like this.
Are you sure you had to? Maybe it could have been saved.
There wasn't enough left of it. He'd like to have bled to death before he got home. There's still a big chance he ain't gonna make it.
He fired first. He shot my Uncle Benjamin. He may not make it either.
It was as if Cyrus and the others didn't hear him. as if it made no difference to them what Finnis had done.
You've been aching to take revenge on us Blackwoods ever since what happened to your pa. But you oughtn't have shot my boy to take out your grudge against me.
I shot Finnis because he shot at us, and not because of what you done to Papa and them.
Michael could tell that his explanation meant nothing. These were a people who recognized no wrong of their own and no right of anyone else. He looked once more at Finnis and thought it probably would have been better had he killed him outright. If he were to say so, he'd probably not leave this place alive.
I am sorry for you, Mrs. Blackwood. The same way I'm sorry for my mother.
Michael saw something leap into her eyes, something beyond anger, beyond even hatred. He saw a wildness there, a stern and vengeful will that reminded him of a sow bear defending her young. He had long wondered what held this family together all these years against the shiftlessness and improvidence of old Cyrus Blackwood. Now he knew. She brought her face up so close that he could feel her breath. Her eyes crackled.
Now you hear me, Michael Lewis. We got that boy yonder to see after right now. He may yet die. If he don't die, he'll be a cripple the rest of his life, just part of a man. But whichever way it goes, my boys will be coming after you. I'll send Luke first. And if Luke don't get you, I'll send Isaac to help him. If them two don't get you, I'll send the others. If they can't get you, I'll kill you myself. And if any of your folks gets in the way, we'll kill them too.
Michael felt a cold chill raise the hair on the back of his neck. Cyrus and the boys might bluster and bluff, but this woman meant what she said. Charity Blackwood pointed to the door.
Now get before I take a notion to finish it here.
Michael moved slowly, trying to let them know that he was not afraid of any of them. And he wasn't, except for the woman. He felt as if he'd been trapped in a den with a mama bear.
Don't send anybody you can't do without.
Michael knew the warning was hollow, for chances were that when they came, he'd be able to do nothing. They wouldn't face him and give him an equal chance. They would shoot at him from ambush, as Finnis had done. And more than likely, they would do the same to anyone else near enough to be considered in the way, or to bear witness before the law. He hoped the Blackwoods couldn't see the cold chill that ran through him and made his skin feel as if it were crawling. Michael didn't look behind him as he walked across the narrow porch and out to his horse. They could easily shoot him in the back, and a strong sense of dread told him they were considering it. But to let them see that dread, it would be weakness, he thought, and the last thing to show a Blackwood or a snarling dog was weakness. He swung up onto the horse before he stole a glance at the cabin. Isaac, third oldest of the Blackwood sons, had followed him partway out from the porch.
Isaac, I've always thought you had some sense. Tell her it's gone far enough. There's been blood spilt on both sides.
He's gone beyond talking now. You heard her. You seen her eyes. As long as you stay in this country, there'll be people killed. Maybe you, maybe us, maybe some of your folks. Oh, I wish I could say different, but I'd be lying to you. You watch yourself, Michael. From now on, take every breath like it was fixing to be your last. One of them will be.
Michael rode away, skin still crawling. He could almost feel a rifle pointed toward his back, but he would not let himself turn and look. He knew when he rode up to the Baxter cabin that the worst had passed. The farmer met him at the horse pen, and he was smiling.
I do believe your uncle's gonna make it. He come right a while ago and talked a little. Seemed real pleased to find your mama there. I think that helped him more than anything we done.
His mother met him at the door. She hugged him briefly out of relief, then pushed him away to look at him.
You went to the Blackwoods, didn't you?
Michael glanced accusingly at his brother, Andrew.
Andrew didn't tell me. I can figure things out for myself. I hope you didn't.
It wasn't no use. I'd already done about all there was to do.
He's dead?
No, but he shot up some. How's Uncle Benjamin?
Well, he ought to live if he don't get blood poisoning.
If we're gonna take him home, we ought to do it before the damp night air sets in.
You and Andrew get the team hitched to the wagon. I'll see if Mrs. Baxter can give us the barry of some blankets.
Andrew drove the wagon with all the competence of a professional freighter, picking the smoothest ground so he wouldn't jostle Benjamin any more than he could help. Michael rode behind, leading Benjamin's horse and a reluctant pack mule. His mother looked back toward him.
why don't you come up and ride alongside of us?
Michael couldn't help glancing toward the woods, which lay off to the left, within rifle range. His skin prickled. He doubted that any of the Blackwoods would already be trying to set an ambush for him. But if they did, he didn't want his mother, or Andrew, or Benjamin in the line of fire.
His mule's crazy enough that if someone was to spook him, he might jump right up into the wagon.
They came, finally, to Benjamin Lewis's farm. Michael felt part of his burden lift, but not all of it. Even as he and Andrew and Cousin Frank carried Benjamin into the house, he cast a glance back over his shoulder toward a dark grove of trees, which could handily hide a man. The range would be long, but a good shot could do it. Andrew gave him a searching look.
You all right, Michael?
Sure I'm all right. Why wouldn't I be?
He helped carry Benjamin to his bed and saw to it that he was made as comfortable as possible. The house seemed to close in on Michael, and he had to go outside. He stood in the open dog run, staring off toward the grove, knowing he was a target, but grimly determined not to let them make him a prisoner in the house. Michael tensed at the sound. The boy, Jonathan, frightened by what he'd seen inside, put his arms around Michael's leg and clung tightly. Michael looked uneasily toward the grove, then back to the boy.
Jonathan, you better go into your mother.
The boy clung until Michael pulled him free and pushed him toward the door.
Go on now.
Reluctantly, Jonathan went, but he looked back, hurt and disappointed. Andrew had come out into the dog run. He glanced toward the grove and seemed to read Michael's mind. Andrew was strongly given to joking most of the time, but he was dead serious now.
They wouldn't shoot a little boy like that.
They might shoot at me and hit him like Finnis hit Uncle Benjamin. Next time it could be any of you.
We can't all hide in the house. We've got to get on about our business and take our chances.
As long as I'm here, I'm a danger to all of you. Looks like I got no choice but to go.
Where to?
I don't know. Someplace. Maybe I'll find out when I get there.
I'll go with you.
You don't even know where I'm going. Neither do I.
Don't matter. If it suits you, it'll suit me.
Sometimes I'm not a pleasure to be with.
You're my brother. I can stand it.
Andrew looked toward the grove again.
I think you need the company. And if them Blackwoods trail along, you could sure use some help.
No, Andrew, I might get you killed.
You're not gone yet. Think on it some.
Andrew went back inside. Michael's gaze turned to the west. A soft breeze had picked up, bringing with it the pleasant spring smell of the new grass and the wildflowers. The freshly turned earth with its winter-stored moisture yielding up to the wind and the sun. It brought memories, fleeting fragments at first, then whole pictures. He remembered another time, another place, when the same fragrances had stirred him. He tried to dismiss the thought, but it wouldn't go away. He told himself it was the last place on earth he wanted to see again. But the breeze was relentless, and Texas would not leave him. Morgan's store was larger and enjoyed a livelier trade than Sizemore Miller's obscure place on the trail down at Miller's Crossing. Around its original log structure, a settlement of sorts had grown. And with the settlement, the store had expanded a little at a time, each new addition not quite fitting architecturally with those that had preceded it. This mattered not at all to the frontier clientele, whose tastes ran to utility rather than to aesthetics. The first log structure was now a storage area at the back, and the store's front was built of sawed lumber, rough but sturdy, a credit to a thriving modern community. Storekeeper Oscar Morgan spread Michael's winter catch of pelts on his front porch and studied them with a critical eye, practiced to discover any flaw. But Michael felt Morgan would be honest with him, within the natural limitations of his calling.
Now, I always thought the world of your daddy, but with all due respect to him, you got these pelts in better shape than he ever did. Mordecai lacked your patience, I'm thinking.
At the moment, Michael didn't feel patient. His rump prickled with impatience to be about the business and gone.
You're in a good place to hear things, Mr. Morgan. Do you know anything about Texas opening up to settlement?
I hear there's been another try by some damn fool named Long to take the country over. Blowed up like all the other tries. Then didn't get killed or prisoners.
Morgan's look turned quizzical.
Hey, you ain't studying on going there, are you? You more than anybody else I know of ought to consider Texas barely one notch better than hell.
Just thinking it might be a good idea if I went someplace. I'd be much obliged if you wouldn't say nothing to anybody.
Michael helped Morgan stack some of the pelts so the storekeeper could have room to take a closer look at others.
It might be a good thing if you was to go somewhere. Nobody's gonna think the worse of you for it.
What do you mean by that?
Luke Blackwood was here a while ago. He'd done a lot of talking.
Michael looked around quickly. He'd been so intent on getting the pelts sold that he hadn't considered the possibility of an attack by the Blackwoods right here in the settlement.
He bought him a jug and was gone before you come. Probably hunted him a place to lay up and get drunk. Everybody around here knows the Blackwoods won't stand up to you, because you're your daddy all over again with the same grit he had, and they're afraid of you. They'll strike you from ambush like a snake. There ain't no shame in a man turning his back on a hopeless situation like that.
I ain't gone anywhere yet.
But you should, and the sooner the better. Now come on in and let's figure out what I owe you.
Michael took part of his pay in supplies, like powder and lead, and a couple of new blankets, a pair of strong, heavy boots. Finding neither Morgan nor anyone else in the settlement much in the mood to buy or trade for his contrary mule, he packed his goods on its back. Before leaving the settlement, he looked carefully for any sign of Luke Blackwood, but saw none. His senses, keened by Morgan's warning, he held to the open places, departing from the trail wherever it led near timber that might furnish Blackwood concealment within rifle range. The trail crossed a place known as Buck Holler, where there stood the cabin of an early settler named Wilson, father of Joseph's new wife and brother to old Amos Wilson, who had died with Papa in Texas. Michael watered the horse and the mule, then rode up to a garden where the jovial Wilson was planting beans. Wilson came to the fence.
Say, howdy, Michael. How's your uncle doing?
Better and better in each day. He should be back on his feet in no time.
Him and me are fixing to be granddaddies, you know.
It grated on Michael that Wilson now seemed to consider his brother Joseph to be Benjamin's son rather than Mordecai's. It was as if Benjamin had completely replaced Mordecai for everybody except Michael. Michael sidestepped the subject.
Seen anything of Luke Blackwood?
Wilson seemed to catch the urgency behind the question.
Well, come by early this morning, riding toward the settlement. I ain't seen him come back. You don't reckon your trouble with them Blackwoods might spill over onto your brothers, do you? My little girl'd be caught right in the middle.
Michael didn't know how to give him a satisfactory answer, so he didn't try.
I'll tell Uncle Benjamin that you inquired after his health.
If I was you, I'd go over and kill all them Blackwood boys like you'd kill out a den of snakes. That'd put an end to the trouble.
I'd have to kill the little uns as well as the big uns, because they'd get to be big uns someday and come hunting me.
Michael left Wilson to his planting. He made a wide swing around the place where Uncle Benjamin had been shot, for it seemed a likely place for the unimaginative Luke to try to set up an ambush. Michael found the farmer Baxter milking his cow. Baxter said he'd not seen Luke. He made somewhat the same general suggestion about the Blackwoods that Wilson had, except a little less sanguine.
They ought to all be put in jail for the good of the community. As for Finnis, it's a damn shame you wasn't a better shot.
Michael led the mule by the cabin he had been sharing with Andrew and his cousin Frank and some of the younger boys. He dropped off the supplies there and then led the two animals down to the pen to turn them loose. Little Jonathan was playing in the barn, chunking rocks at some half-wild cats kept there to control the mice.
One of them cats ever gets his claws into your butt, you'll wish you left them alone.
Andrew came down to the barn and watched Michael unsaddle. He pointed his chin at the mule.
Thought you was gonna get rid of him. I reckon them settlement folks are good judges of a mule.
I reckon they are. Couldn't find anybody who wanted him.
I saw what you brought back with you. Looks like you're fixing to make a trip.
Where are you going, Michael? Can I come too, please?
Michael shook his head.
Ain't said I'm going anywhere yet. How's Uncle Benjamin?
Stronger today. He's tough. Like Papa used to be.
Nobody's like Papa used to be.
Michael picked up his rifle and started out the gate, and then turned.
You coming, Jonathan?
The boy picked up another rock and started looking for the cats.
Mama didn't call supper yet.
Well, you better be listening when she does. I ain't coming out to hunt for you.
Andrew walked up to the house with Michael.
That kid thinks you're the greatest man in the world, except for his daddy. You treat him like he's a stray dog instead of your brother.
Half brother.
Michael realized how narrow that sounded.
I don't intend to be that way, it's just...
He realized he couldn't articulate his feelings. He didn't fully understand them himself.
The boy's all right. It's me, not him.
Papa would have been crazy about him. Jonathan's a Lewis. He's one of us.
Michael did not like feeling guilty.
I'll go fetch him when supper time comes.
Michael looked first into the kitchen, where his mother and sisters and girl cousins were fixing supper. But he went to his mother's and uncle's bedroom on the other side of the dog run. Benjamin Lewis was propped up in his bed, a feather tick covering only the lower part of his body. His shoulder and chest were swathed in bandages, not much whiter than his face. But Michael could see strength in his eyes, deep blue eyes that reminded him too much of Papa.
Did you get everything sold? The pelts, the mule?
The pelts, not the mule. Guess I'll just have to learn to out-stubborn him some more.
Michael can do that, all right.
Andrew was still inclined to look for the humor, something Michael seemed to lack. Benjamin smiled. It looked good on him, Michael thought.
So what now, Michael? You studied any more about that meadow I offered you?
I've thought about it.
Michael didn't want to worry his uncle with the rest of it, though. So far as he knew, nobody had told Benjamin about the Blackwood family's threat.
Well, then, what do you say?
Michael knew he was going to have to tell him no. As he cast around for the best way to say it, Cousin Frank pushed the door open. Urgency was in his eyes.
Michael, I've got to see you. Now!
Uncle Ben, I'll be back.
Michael followed Frank out into the dog run.
I was just coming up from the field when I seen Luke Blackwood run his horse out of that grove yonder and up to the back of the barn. He's got a rifle.
Michael had propped his own rifle outside the door to his uncle's room on the dog run. He grabbed it. A realization struck him.
The barn? Jonathan's out there.
Frank's eyes widened.
You stay here out of sight.
Jonathan! Jonathan, come here to me.
Frank, you stop where you're at. Don't you come no closer.
Michael's throat went dry. He knew the voice, Luke Blackwood.
I've got this boy here. I traded to you for Michael.
Mama! Papa!
Frank stopped halfway between the house and the barn and looked back over his shoulder.
He's got it, Michael. I can see the boat.
Michael Lewis, is that you up yonder? I want you, Michael. You come on out here and I'll let this boy go.
Michael's heartbeat quickened. He had no doubt that if he went, Luke would kill him. But if he did not go, Luke Blackwood was the sort who might very well take out his frustrations on a small boy. Michael's breath came short, and his hand went wet with cold sweat against the rifle. But he pondered for only a moment, for he saw no choice. He stepped out away from the dog run into the open.
I'm coming, Luke. Let the boy go.
Michael walked up even with Frank.
I want you to fire that rifle into the air, Michael, and then lay it down.
You let the boy go first.
No! You do what I tell you.
Michael saw the anxiety in Frank's eyes. The whole family doted on Jonathan, except Michael. He held the rifle tightly against his shoulder and raised the muzzle high. He carefully laid the rifle on the ground along with his powder horn. His eyes locked solemnly on Frank's. He could see a promise there. Whatever happened, Luke Blackwood would not get away. Michael walked toward the barn. He could see Luke now and Jonathan between the logs that made up the horse pen. Jonathan was struggling to break free. Luke had a grip on the boy's arm with his left hand. With his right, he held a long rifle precariously to his shoulder.
Let him go now, Luke.
I want you closer, Michael. If you try anything, I'll shoot this boy.
You can't, Luke. You just got one shot, and if you use it on him, you know I'll get you. I'll kill you with my hands.
Michael's hand was on the gate. He slid open the bar that held it. The gate swung heavily on rawhide hinges. He stood then, 20 feet from Luke Blackwood, and looked him in the face. He saw fear in Luke's eyes, but he also saw murder.
You won't get away from here, Luke. There's other Lewises at the house and guns. You can kill me, but you'll never get to that grove. Turn the boy loose.
This boy is what's going to get me away from here alive.
Michael could have argued with him, could have told him he was justified in shooting Finnis, that Finnis was crippled through his own doing. But such argument would be wasted, as it had been wasted at the Blackwood cabin. So he stood and looked silently into the muzzle of the rifle. He remembered another day and other rifles, and he felt the same dread churning his stomach. He saw the intention in Luke's eyes a second before Luke made his move. To stabilize the rifle, he had to turn Jonathan loose and bring his left hand up to the long barrel. In that moment, Michael made a quick move to his right. Jonathan broke free, then turned angrily and kicked Luke on the shin. Luke tried to watch Michael while he booted the boy away, The rifle barrel wobbled. Michael saw the pan flash and threw himself to the ground. Michael knew he had missed, and Luke knew too. He stared a second in wild terror as Michael pushed himself to his feet. The boy clung to Luke's pants leg, trying to kick him again. Luke turned and vaulted across the fence, dropping his rifle as he hit the ground. After stopping to pick it up, he sprinted to where his horse was tied. Michael grabbed the top rail of the fence and swung himself over. He landed awkwardly and went down. He saw Luke's horse shy away in fright at Luke running headlong toward it. The horse broke the tied bridle rein and jerked free. Luke grabbed at what was left of the rein, swung into the saddle, and drummed his heels in panic against the animal's ribs. In his haste, he had dropped his rifle a second time, and he didn't stop to pick it up. Frank Lewis came running, loading Michael's rifle as he moved. Andrew hurried from the house with another rifle, but he was considerably behind. Jonathan angrily hurled a rock at the fleeing Luke, but it went hardly beyond the fence. He seemed unaware of the danger that had just passed him by.
Little brother, you got a lot of spunk. By God, you are Lewis.
Frank Lewis braced the rifle against a corner post and took a bead. The bullet kicked up dust just ahead of Luke's running horse. Michael was still holding the boy in his arms.
Frank, I think you better stick to farming.
Andrew reached them just as Luke's horse was about to plunge into the grove. He took a wild shot for luck, but had none.
It's just as well. If you'd killed him, the rest of the Blackwoods would be after the whole family and not just after me.
I'd hate to be the one who has to wash his britches tonight.
He won't be coming back.
But Michael remembered the fury in Mrs. Blackwood's eyes. And the thing she had said.
If Luke don't get you, I'll send Isaac to help him. If them two don't get you, I'll send the others. If they can't get you, I'll kill you myself. And if any of your folks get in the way, we'll kill them too.
Michael had no doubt she had meant every word. Luke was only the first. He saw Patience, holding a hand over her alarmed eyes, moving quickly toward the barn to see what the commotion had been about. Michael's younger sisters followed her. He set Jonathan on the ground.
You better run to your mama. She's fretting about you.
Jonathan did not go. He took Michael's hand.
Who was that man, Michael? Why was he so mad?
Some people are just mad all the time. Like, some boys are good all the time. Now go be good and go to your mama.
Patience reached the gate and knelt, swinging Jonathan up into her arms.
Oh!
Her eyes asked the question, so she had no need to put it into words. Michael felt a twinge of guilt, even though he realized it had been none of his fault. The boy in her arms had been in jeopardy for Michael's sake.
Luke Blackwood had Jonathan. Used Jonathan to make Michael go to him.
Patience moved up close to Michael and studied him with grave concern.
I heard shots.
Nobody's hit. That's the main thing.
Patience held the boy tightly.
He may come back.
Michael knew now that he had no choice.
I'll leave him no reason to.
By the stricken look in her eyes, he knew she understood his meaning. There was no need to add to the pain by putting it into words.
Supper's about ready.
We'll be along directly.
Michael watched her walk back toward the house, the boy still in her arms, the girls following. He turned to Frank and Andrew.
I can make a few miles before dark. Even if they was to come at daylight, they'd be too late. They wouldn't know where to start looking for me.
Michael glanced regretfully at the horse and mule he had turned loose in the pen a little earlier.
Looks like there'll be no rest for the weary.
We could all go over to the Blackwoods in a bunch and let them know that the Lewises stick together. Maybe they back off.
Michael knew better.
They stick together, too. We just set off a family feud and kill each other one or two at a time till there was nobody left, hardly. We've known it to happen with other families. I don't intend it to happen to this one just because of me.
Let me and Andrew go with you.
No, Frank. Uncle Benjamin won't be able to work for a long time, and there's plenty to do with spring just started. You being the oldest, it'll be your farm someday. Your place is here, helping your daddy.
But it won't be my farm. I'll have to go out and find my own. Let me go with you and we'll find us one together.
The temptation was almost overpowering. Of all his brothers, Andrew was the one most like Michael in many respects. Attuned to the forest, the trail, yet he could be equally at home in the cornfield or working with the handful of cattle the family owned. But there were too many reasons not to accept. The chance was slim, to be sure, but there was at least an outside possibility that the Blackwoods might manage to follow Michael and exact the price the old lady had set. He thought it unlikely that they would leave Andrew unharmed if he got in the way, and having all the Lewis determination, he would most certainly get in the way. Even if the Blackwoods did not find them, there was the great uncertainty about what lay ahead. One Lewis already lay buried in a faraway place. Michael did not intend for Andrew to risk the same fate.
I've always traveled best alone and faster.
Michael turned toward the house, putting argument behind him. Supper done, Michael went into Benjamin Lewis's room and took his uncle's hand. Benjamin had already gotten wind of Michael's plans, and he understood the reason behind them. He squeezed Michael's fingers with more strength than Michael had expected.
When you going, son?
I'm fixing to leave now.
Benjamin stared at him a long, silent moment.
You'll need a better horse than the one you've got. Take Big Red.
He didn't bring Papa any luck.
It wasn't the fault of the horse. You'll be glad you're taking him.
Benjamin gave him a sad study.
You're like one of my own sons to me, Michael. You leaving, it's almost like having a death in the family.
But that's why I'm leaving. So there won't be any. Once I'm gone, they'll have no reason to bother the rest of you.
Your mother'll take this hard. Like the time your daddy left and never came back.
She's strong. She's got other family. And she's got you.
Michael looked away, surprised that he could bring himself to say it. Benjamin squeezed Michael's hand again. His eyes misted.
I didn't agree with your daddy about some things, but he was my brother and I loved him. When I look at you, I can still see him, like when he was 21. He'd be proud of you, Michael. I'm proud to be your kin.
And I'm proud you're mine.
His mother watched while he hugged his sisters, Annie the last, then his brothers. She walked out into the yard where Andrew held the sorrel horse and the pack mule waiting for him. All there was to say, she said with her eyes. She hugged him hard, then stepped back and let him go. As he rode into the woods, he turned for a last glance. She was still standing there watching him go, as she had so often watched his father leave. He rode long into the darkness, pausing only a few minutes at Joseph's place to say goodbye to his older brother and the girl who had become Joseph's wife. Having eaten supper before setting out, he had no need to stop and cook a meal, or even to build a fire when he finally decided to give the animals a rest. He slept but little and was up at first light, eating hastily and without relish, nervous to be on his way. He left the trail, striking off on his own to confound the Blackwood should they make an attempt at following. He rode north a while, simply to confuse the issue, then dropped southwestward for some time before setting a generally westward course across forests and meadows and hills that alternated one with the other. Any Blackwood would play hell ever catching up to him now. In a clearing in a wood, he made a fire and fixed some coffee and bacon and ate cold bread Joseph's wife had insisted he take. He slept as if he'd been knocked in the head and did not awaken the next morning until the rising sun struck him in the face. He took his time fixing breakfast, watching the animals graze. Michael had been on the trail for about 2 hours. A sense of alarm tingled through him at the sound. He gripped the rifle and turned the sorrel horse around, facing back to the east. After a moment, convincing himself it was imagination, he rode on. At what he guessed to be noontime, he stopped at the bank of a creek to let the animals rest and graze, and he built a small fire to broil some bacon. He was about done when he saw his horse suddenly swing its head around, ears pointing. Michael grabbed the rifle and dropped onto his belly behind a tree, trading the rifle toward the sound. His heartbeat quickened.
That you up yonder, Michael? Don't you be shooting at me now.
Michael pushed to his feet and stepped out into the open. From the ground, Andrew Lewis looked like a man fully grown, though he lacked some yet. He looked enough like Mordecai that Michael had a hard time feeling as angry as he wanted to be.
Little brother, you are a vexation and a pain. I might have shot you for a Blackwood.
Andrew grinned like a possum sucking eggs.
For a Blackwood? I'd have been mad at you for the rest of my life.
It would have been a damn short life. The crooked trail I left, how the hell did you follow me?
You know I was always the best tracker in the family. Papa taught me that.
Why did you follow? I said you couldn't go.
Papa told you the same thing once. You trailed behind him till he couldn't send you back. Anyway, I've already said my goodbyes at home. They thought it was a good idea for me to come along and watch out for you.
Watch out for me?
You got a way of getting in trouble when you're by yourself.
I'll be taking care of you instead of the other way around.
You won't hardly know I'm here. I'll be quieter than a little mouse.
Michael knew the only way to make Andrew go home would be to take him there. He couldn't do that.
first time you make one of them bad jokes, I'll ride off and leave you behind.
No jokes. You never understood them anyhow.
What does that mean?
Means you got too serious a turn of mind. You ought to laugh more.
It's a serious world and no place for a damned fool.
That runs in the family.
Sergeant Alessandro Zaragoza suspected that had the military leadership known how badly he wanted to return to San Antonio de Bar to rejoin his wife Elvira, the company would never have been transferred south from Nacogdoches. It was not the way of the military command to recognize the wishes of the men, except to deny them. Even Lieutenant Armando Rodriguez seemed in good humor, pleased to leave the primitive pleasures and limited social climate of the little northern Texas community for the relative comfort of the more populated bar. He had not captured and dispatched an insurrectionist in more than a year. Despite many a diligent search and occasional hot pursuit, the sanctuary of nearby American Louisiana was too quickly reached. And those anti-royalist agitators who had survived this long were not easily caught unaware. Rodriguez had become wearied by the frustrating chore of searching out and expelling Norte Americano squatters who stubbornly crossed the ill-marked line from Louisiana, making themselves at home on the king's soil. They thumbed their noses at authority and sprang up everywhere like weeds in a garden, declaring that land unused was a waste in the eyes of the Lord and that therefore theirs was virtually a biblical obligation. While he was driving one out, two more would slip in behind him. General Joaquin de Arredondo had ordered that they be relentlessly sought and evicted lest they take root and multiply, and perhaps lend motivation and strength to more filibustering expeditions out of the infernal United States. But the general was far to the south in Monterey. He didn't understand that these people infested the frontier like locusts, building their rude cabins in the edges of the pine forest, breaking out land to which they had no claim, trading in contraband goods from Nacogdoches and points to the east. Not even an occasional application of the sword seemed to deter the invasion, though God knew Rodriguez had tried. He had always been an eager administrator of justice in the name of his king, especially against insurrectionists and Norte Americanos. He had no dread of spilled blood, so long as it was someone else's. The Royal Road from Nacogdoches to Bar had the name, but it was hardly more than a crude trace, certainly not a road in the sense of those that traversed the settled portions of Mexico farther south. Travelers along its path always faced the hazard of miscreants who took advantage of the poorly defended, relieving any burden of valuable goods and possessions that might be weighing heavily upon their shoulders, and sometimes of the animals that carried them. There was also the possibility of confrontation with the wild Indians who periodically invaded from those dark and unknown regions to the west, to which they retreated with impunity after exacting their toll. But neither bandits nor Indians were likely to attack a body of soldiers armed with muskets and lances. Zaragoza rode watchfully, but with confidence. They encountered few people along the way, which in one sense he felt was a pity, for the potential of this land was limitless. It was blessed with great forests and open valleys of deep soil the Lord must have intended for the plow. Settled by the proper sort of industrious people, it could be a colonial jewel in the king's crown. But the royal government, during its years of troubles in Mexico since the first rebellion, had made it policy to encourage settlement only within regions which it could control with its military presence. People had a tendency to want to think for themselves and question authority when they were allowed to disperse too widely. Lieutenant Rodriguez had often pointed to the Americans as an example of this truth. They took a perverse pride in their independence and their ability to thrive when not fettered by what they regarded as excessive law. They seemed not to realize that the only justification for the common man's existence was to serve those born to higher station, as Rodriguez served his king and as these misbegotten mestizo soldiers served him. They came across a couple of cart trains carrying merchandise, which the merchant said was for the settlers in Nacogdoches. Zaragoza suspected most of it was intended for contraband trade with Louisiana. Smuggling was among the region's chief enterprises, equal to, if not greater than, agriculture. Zaragoza assumed the lieutenant was well aware of the intended transgressions, but the papers were in order, thanks to appropriate payment to the officials in Bar in the form of the mordida, the little bite. The lieutenant went through the proper procedures, inspecting the cargoes and the manifests with military correctness. Zaragoza was sure Rodriguez came out of the encounters a little richer, though the officer was too practiced in the ways of the world to let his subordinate see him accept any coin. That they all knew he did was of no matter. They had not seen him. It was a fact of life in the Spanish colonial system that the reality was easily overlooked so long as appearances remained proper. Sergeant Zaragoza whiled away the long, weary hours on the trail by remembering the lovely face of his wife Elvira and picturing his happy reunion with her. He had sent her south to her family in Bar as her pregnancy became advanced, for she and her child would receive better care among her own. Once there, it had been agreed that she would be well served to stay, for life was precarious in a small and backward outpost such as Nacogdoches. That had been more than 2 years ago. He had a son whose second birthday had already been celebrated without his being given leave to go and see him. Another reason to hate Lieutenant Rodriguez. He remained true to Elvira during their long separation, though to have taken himself a mistress would have been accepted, even expected. If forced to submit to Inquisition, he would have to admit that the opportunity for infidelity had been small in such a sparsely settled community. He had seen no woman there whose beauty approached that of Elvira. Any temptation had been transient and easily put aside. His excitement built as they began to see the rough limestone hills that rose to the north and west of San Antonio de Bar. The Royal Road skirted them, its originators having judiciously remained with greater or less demanding terrain to the east. It was here, and south along the San Antonio River, that the government almost a century ago had settled Canary Islanders to establish its hold on this land against encroachment by France. Attempts to move west into the rough hills had always been thrown back by the fearsome Comanches and Apaches, enemies to each other but equally hostile to the settlers. Even now, Comanches occasionally rode boldly through the streets of Bar, silently daring one and all to make a move against them. There were seldom enough soldiers to meet the challenge in force, certainly not enough to beat back Indians so fearsome. The people of Bar Pueblo fervently wished for settlers to occupy the land between them and the hills, to act as a buffer against the Indians. Those occasional brave souls who tried either gave up and moved back to the fringes of the town, or were buried in the soil they had tried to cultivate. The king held tied, but Comanche and Apache held the land. The Galindo family's farm lay just northeast of the town, part of the land running up to Salado Creek. The Nacogdoches Road passed nearby, and Zaragoza felt the delicious agony of seeing from some distance the flat-topped stone house in which Elvira would be living with her parents, brothers, and sisters. He watched closely, hoping that by some stroke of good fortune he might see her in the yard or upon the road, but he did not. It would bring him refusal and a stern rebuke from Rodriguez if he were to ask permission to stop, even briefly. Riding through the narrow, confining streets beside Rodriguez at the head of the company, Zaragoza could see little change since he had been sent north. The small houses of stone and adobe were the same as he remembered them. The town had not grown. On the contrary, it had shrunk as a result of all the troubles, rebellions and invasions, large and small. The old mission San Antonio de Valero, which some called the Alamo because of the cottonwoods, was gradually crumbling into ruins. The San Fernando Cathedral had taken on its religious duties, standing across the plaza from the governor's palace. Zaragoza wondered if Governor Antonio Martinez watched through his window as the company rode by, and whether he took its presence as reassurance or as a threat. Many citizens regarded the troops as a greater menace than the Indians. When Armando Rodriguez gave the orders, that fear held a grim validity. Zaragoza hoped, but did not actually expect, the lieutenant to grant him leave to ride out for a reunion with his wife. In this supposition, he was correct, for it was the following day before Rodriguez finally gave him grudging permission to absent himself from the garrison. He did so then only because the whole company, except those on punishment, were freed for a night to seek the pleasures of the Pueblo and divest themselves of the meager pay which jingled temporarily in their pockets. If the people of the town sometimes wished for protection from the soldiers, Zaragoza thought there were times when the soldiers also needed protection from at least some elements of the town. Dressed in the best uniform he had, every button polished, his black horse curried and brushed, Zaragoza approached the Galindo house, trembling as if before the worst battle he had ever faced. He vacillated between heady anticipation and paralyzing self-doubt, wondering if he should not have sent a note by messenger to let her know of his coming. But such airs were for officers, not for soldiers of low degree, even one so fortunate as to hold the rank of sergeant. By the standards of Mexico, the Galindos were far from wealthy. By the standards of isolated San Antonio de Bar, they were at least comfortable, for they owned fields and horses and mules and cattle, and every member of the family of an age to do so was able to read and write. This relatively high standing had once given Zaragoza reason to question whether he was being pretentious in pressing his suit of Elvira, for this presumed inequality he was not certain he could justify. The late afternoon sun had descended almost to the rough tops of the brooding western hills as he rode up the tree-shaded lane toward the rambling stone house. Several dogs bounded out to meet him. Toward the barns, he could see men unburdening work oxen, driving in cows for the evening milking. They paid him little attention, for these were hired laborers who lived in small stone and adobe hovels well away from the main house, separated from the Galindo family by both a considerable physical distance and the many-layered class distinctions that put each person in his place on the day of birth and rarely let him move in any direction except downward. A small child played in front of the house, a boy he took to be about 2 years old. His heart raced with the realization that this was his son. The boy became aware of the approaching stranger and fearfully retreated inside. Evidently, he had been taught about soldiers. Zaragoza checked all his buttons and brushed his uniform with one hand. Then he dismounted.
Elvira!
He watched the door for what seemed an hour before she opened it and paused there, more beautiful than he remembered her. As recognition struck her, she rushed into his arms. As her warmth smothered him, he wanted to do much more than hold and kiss her. He wanted to sweep her up into his arms and carry her straight to the bedroom. But there were priorities, and he did not have to report back to the garrison until tomorrow. He stared into her shining face.
Elvira, time has been a friend to you.
No. It has stolen too much from us.
The way she stared at him, he suspected the same wild urge ran through her. But she recognized the proprieties as well. She took his arm and led him into the house, much more slowly and gently than he really wanted to go.
Come. It is time you meet your son, Manuel.
Time came for supper. Old Mauro Galindo, the father of Elvira and eight others, walked up from the barns with his son Nicholas beside him. Nicholas, the firstborn and a year older than Elvira, had much of the old man in his face, but had something else besides, an anger in his black eyes that had been there as long as Zaragoza had known the family. It was an anger born of the first aborted rebellion against Spain, an anger that had never cooled. Because Zaragoza wore the uniform of a Spanish soldier, Nicholas had never been more than politely cool toward him. The old man vigorously shook Zaragoza's hand and welcomed him back to the bosom of the family, as Señora Galindo had done soon after Zaragoza's arrival. But Zaragoza saw little welcome in Nicholas's eyes. Nicholas stared at the uniform, and he frowned. The evening was long and uncomfortable, partly because of Nicholas's coldness, and partly because Zaragoza wanted so badly to say his good nights and retreat with Elvira to their bedroom. Try as Elvira and her mother might, they could not long keep the conversation deflected from politics and war. The elder Galindo professed to have no interest in politics. He declared that he had seen first one and then another authority figure come and go.
It makes no difference who is in charge of the government. They are all like apples, sweet at first, then rotten with time. Power and money, these are the spoilers of honorable men.
There is one good thing to be said for the Americanos. They are greedy and grasping and want what does not belong to them, but at least they are free men. They bow to no one. It will be like that for us one day. We will not forever be the slaves to the Gachope.
Nicholas pointed to the boy Manuel, Zaragoza's son.
He will grow up to be a free man.
He will grow up to work for his living like all the rest of us. Do you think it makes any difference to the horse whether the rider is a king or a peasant? Do you think it makes any difference to the seed in the ground whether the man who pushes the plow is a slave or a free man?
Nicholas thrust his chin forward as if in challenge.
It makes a difference to the man with the plow.
If you will excuse me, it's time to put Manuel to bed.
Zaragoza kissed him, but the little boy pulled away, afraid. It would take time. Nicholas turned to Zaragoza.
You still belong to that damned Rodriguez, I suppose?
Zaragoza frowned. He did not like the feeling of belonging to anyone, least of all to Rodriguez.
I serve under him.
Rodriguez has the blood of many good men to answer for. He will burn in hell.
I do not doubt it. But for the present, he is very much alive.
That could be remedied.
Zaragoza waited impatiently for the old man to say goodnight and give the cue for the conversation to break up. He did, finally, plodding away with his graying wife toward their bedroom. Nicholas tarried a minute longer, his eyes burning a hole in Zaragoza. Nicholas pushed to his feet and went to the door, pausing there.
You may tell that dog Rodriguez the fire of freedom has been lighted. It will consume him one day soon, him and all his kind. It will consume anyone else who stands in their way.
Carrying a candle, Elvira took Zaragoza's hand and led him out into the open patio, to the door of her bedroom. He closed the door behind them.
Elvira, Nicolas puts everyone in his family in danger. If Rodriguez hears of his talk, there is no telling how far he may go.
I will speak to him about it tomorrow. There has been enough talking for tonight.
Elvira turned eagerly into his arms, and the time for talk was past.